I was a model. My career started in 1981, right out of high school. And
how were you discovered, or did you?
No, that's cool. I was discovered at my university. Not university. I was going to City College, and my first year, and a high school teacher who was a history teacher discovered me, and he used to scout young guys for this photographer named Jim French. Jim French shot. He created a magazine and this empire of shooting male erotica, like homoerotica, wow. That was really. Really beautiful, really amazing stuff, but it was very niche, and it was very, like, bears and big muscles and big boners and all that, and there was, like, so he used to scout young guys for this for this photographer. The teacher's name was Joe House. He's passed now. I can say his name. He was a very odd character, but he was nice to me, and he kind of, like, educated. I was very naive when I was a kid, and he kind of educated me on, like, at that time from junior high, I had, like, bodybuilding, so I'd, like, just created this crazy body, and worked out really, really hard, and I didn't know what I was doing with it. My biggest dream in life was to have a gym in my name, and, like, you know, that was gonna be the end all be all of my life. And
any steroids?
No, never.
Really?
No, I never wanted to do steroids. I was always, like, a purist. Like, I mean, you know, I'll get through this story real quick, but so Joe introduced me to Jim French. It was the very first legitimate, you know, paid job I did, standing in front of a camera, and it was me naked, dressed up like the village people. It was like I was a cowboy in one picture, and I was like a construction guy with a hard hat, and you know, it was just very, it was very funny. I was an Indian. It was like literally very cliched gay male imagery that was like kind of a thing that they, and at that time, and you know, I was like butt naked all day with boners, just like doing that thing, and that was my introduction into being photographed and actually being, you know, somebody. Like, the first person that ever told me I was beautiful was a man. It was an older man, and I didn't have a father at that time. My parents divorced when I was 7. So I didn't grow up with a father figure. So these men, Joe introduced me to a few other photographers, and they'd photographed me to nude. So I exchanged nude photography, like art photography, to put my first portfolios together to be a model. And from that, I met somebody that one of those men became my manager, and I started, you know, to dance classes like ballet and jazz and all that stuff and all that. So I could, you know, kind of nurture some skills and some talent so I could, like, further my modeling. And from that, I moved eventually to LA, and I had to make a decision if I wanted to be an actor or a model or a dancer. And I decided to go for the coins, and I became a model. And my modeling career, I mean, it's still used to today. It's wild. I've had a lot of experiences all through that time.
I have a friend named Eric, and he's a model for Gucci, Versace, and stuff like that. And
right.
He says there's a lot of drugs, a lot of drinking.
Oh, man. Can, like, you relate? Well, I started, I started in the 80s, right? Mid-80s, when there was, like, fucking everybody was on everything. They were on pills. They were on cocaine, psychedelics.
But you're straight edge.
I was hardcore straight edge. Hardcore straight edge. I didn't start using any kind of thing until I was 24. And there's a story around that. I can tell that too. But I wanted to say, like, early on, which was really strange, because, like, my inclination was never to be photographed. I hated myself. I hated my face. When I looked at, like, I literally, you know, I had something inside of me that just a really deep self-hatred, and I don't know why. I don't know where it came from. One of my first times I ever got drunk, I was with my friend Lloyd. And we drank all of Uncle Frank's booze. Like, we literally drank all of his booze and just filled it back up with water. We didn't even bother coloring it or nothing. We just mixed it all together and just got blasted. And there's a moment, like, we went driving as his uncle's Delta 88 across this big bridge, and we were just out of our minds. And we came, you know, we did spin outs in this big ass car and drove, and we closed our eyes driving across across this bridge. It was like a 100-foot bridge. And we were just like, it was crazy because we were like on this thrill hit. And it was the very first time I drank, and we just got like blacked out. And when we got back to the house, I was just looking at myself, and I was like tripping. Like, I felt like I was tripping on acid, even though I had no idea or any consciousness of that kind of, a sensation. I was just fucked. And I just started punching myself in the face super hard because I was, like, hating what I was looking at. And I only tell that story because, you know, I was just, like, black eyes, bloody face. My friend was trying to stop me, and I was just wailing on myself. And just blood was all on my face and running down my body and stuff. And I was, like, like, just right off the bat, I kind of realized, like,
first
time doesn't really work for me.
Yeah.
You know, like, getting up like that. And then, like, you know, that I was, like I said, I never did anything until that night. And then I didn't. And that probably happened when I was 17. And then from that point on until I turned 24, I went straight edge 100%. That didn't touch anything. And my father was a drunk. My older brother was a drunk and homeless. My dad ended up homeless, and my younger brother has been for about 6 years now and struggles with. And, you know, I don't know why that is, you know, all that kind of.
Your opportunities to drink again, and you're like, fuck that.
Yeah, no, like, because I was so obsessed with, like, I trained martial arts. I taught myself how to fight. I had all my homies, and we would spar together. So I learned how to fight just by looking at Black Belt magazine. I had my two Bibles was Black Belt magazine and Pumping Iron. It was not Pumping. What was it called? Belt magazine. And what was it? Weeders.
The Bodybuilding Encyclopedia?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I read, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger's.
But you can't whenever. Drink doing that.
No, like.
I'm saying that's the oxymoron, yeah, that's the opposite.
I just want to be opposite of what my brother was and my father was, yeah. You know? And. Yeah, and so the irony of, like, me hating myself, I hated my teeth, I hated my nose, I just thought I was, like, the ugliest thing on earth, and that propelled me to build myself up, my body up, the exterior, you know, I just needed to do that, and I saw pictures of, like, Steve Reeves, like, the old Hollywood, like, kind of guys that were all fit, and I was like, that's what I need to be, and the irony being that, you know, I hated the way I looked, but that's what became my career. And I was like standing in front of a camera. And, you know, the early part, you know, one of the things that kind of probably sustained my career was that I was kind of fearless about things. I didn't, you know, no models ever wanted to take off their clothes. I was like, yeah, let's get this off and like do, you know, and like, you know, be real.
And that was before you started drinking.
That was before I started drinking.
Yeah.
And, you know, and before that too, I started burning myself. I started smoking. The first thing, well, I'll tell a quick story. I was working with a famous photographer at the time. His name was Herb Ritz. He had discovered me. He was like one of the main ones that kind of like propelled me into my career. I was very fortunate. I got to work with Herb Ritz, Bruce Weber, Greg Gorman. Like these were people that like, you know, they iconified my body. At that time in the 80s, in the early 80s. So it was like, it was all about, it was like not me, it was like this shell, like, you know, and I was, but I just was a part of this art collective of creating art. You know, I felt like I was a part of creating art. And I was on this photo shoot one day, I was in Malibu, and it was like one of the, I don't know what it was at the time. You know, I was like, I think I was really mentally going through some weird, as far as like people appreciating me and looking at me as this body, right? Because I was known as, my agent coined a term that I was the body of LA, me and this other guy, Fred Harding. And we were the only dudes at that time because models were skinny and they were like, you know, collegiate looking. And I'm like this, you know, funky looking dude. My agent Omar started this kind of new European. He brought this, he was like a groundbreaker in bringing to the States, making men, it was a interesting period where it took this kind of very all American, very clean cut, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes, or dark hair and blue eyes, really, really chiseled, really like college guys, right? And it changed with me and some other guys that Omar discovered that were very, that had big noses, big cheekbones, huge lips, like really interesting looking people. And they were, most of us were European besides myself. And it created like this new opening, and it was this transitional time when they had discovered in the commercial industry of fashion, right, that they could use men and their bodies and their interesting faces that were outside of the box of what the norm was, and kind of just break new ground and using men as sexual tools, basically, to commercialize and sell like underwear and different kinds of things that showed off bodies, right, of men. And that was being, but there were a lot of gay photographers at the time, the guys that I'd mentioned earlier. And this was a big movement at the time of utilizing men sexually in commercial art,
yeah,
commercial photography and commercial like advertisements and stuff like that. Yeah, so it was really interesting. And what I was alluding to before was that I felt like I wasn't appreciated for what I had inside my head, you know? And then, so I'm doing this photo shoot in Malibu. There's this really amazing model. Her name was Tatiana Patisse. She's passed away now. A big girl. She was about 6 foot, something like that. And so I'm butt naked in Malibu during the winter. My dick's like all, you know, shrunk up. It's freezing. Like I'm like on my hands and knees, and Tatiana's standing on my back. It's a very beautiful, iconic image that Herbert shot. And I snapped. I had a full meltdown in my head. And it was almost like a Fellini movie. And I don't know if you know Fellini movies. He has these crazy, wild characters, and they go very dreamy sometimes. And I felt like I was tripping on acid all of a sudden. I was kind of like exhausted. I was getting hypothermia because it was cold out. She's shaking like hell, and she's probably like a buck 20, something like that. She's a big girl, buck 30, and standing on my back and my hands, I'm like starting to shake, and I'm like, and I uncontrollably shaking. And I was like, and I was just like, I started tripping, and I just look at everybody, and it's like in slow motion in my head, and everybody's, you know, like clapping and like, oh my God, that's so amazing, that's so beautiful. And in my head, I just was like, you all die. You, I can't stand this anymore. I'm done. Fuck you all. And I literally just like the next day I start smoking cigarettes. I had a girlfriend at the time. There was big, this chick that was just a party girl, and she partied and everything, and I was straight edge. And I was like, give me a cigarette. Like after that shoot, I was just like, I'm done. I got my first tattoo. And then I just started on the road to self-destruction. Just like, I'm like literally in my mind, I'm like, okay, you guys, this is what you like. I'm going to destroy it. Like that was what happened in my head when I snapped.
What are some personal stories of why you felt like that? Like the way people treated you, or they were taking advantage of you, or like they thought you were less than, or like,
I think it's all that. I think, you know, like, you know, in those times you're like, as a model, in those times, like, you know, I would be on a set, you know, changing my clothes, and you'd have like, you know, and a lot of the, you know, and I don't have any problem with gay people. I've been around it my whole life. You know, I've had my experiences in that, you know, area of my life. And so there's no hate. And at that time, it was a very, just an open world, you know. Like I said, people were all up. They were coming off of, you know, their drug binges, or they're, you know, hungover from the night before. So there was always this energy of like total freedom in the beginning days of my career, and people were very loosey goosey. Like I could be like, ah, me too, because I was me too'd a lot. Like, you know, I had hands all over me. People would just like reach into your underpants and shift your dick around to get it in the right place and all that, you know, grab your ass.
People,
they were just
with power.
Yeah. Like photographers, the hair, makeup, whatever. It was kind of just that way, you know? And, yeah, it's funny. Like, you know, today the things that happened in that time would never have gotten, you couldn't get away with it at all. There was this one photographer I heard about that used to jerk off behind his camera while shooting girls. Like, and because he was such a big deal, I'm not going to say his name, but because he was such a big deal, nobody ever did anything. there was never any, you know, any repercussions to ill behavior. Like, you know, guys had their hands on girls constantly. It was like such a funny time. It's such a weird time. It was a time capsule of like something that, you know, that shit was just like just overlooked.
I wonder why did it take so long for somebody to go, yo, me too?
It took when it happened because people like, because you couldn't, because people of power, right? You couldn't do anything about that. You couldn't, otherwise you would lose your career. So, you know, like if, you know, I never fit anybody for a job, right? But, you know, there are, you know, you have friends. I had sexual encounters with people that wasn't related to getting a job, you know, with photographers or different, you know, people in the industry. But there are guys that like got very successful because they were the right photographer and like, you know, to get that thing on, you know what I mean? Yeah, to get ahead and to not be shunned on. And those, and you're not going to say to them because they're going to just, you know, you're getting thrown the chips because you're not going to rat some out just the way it was.
Imagine how must it feel when you're like, knowing that you did that and you're being more successful and everyone else knows you did that? Probably a terrible feeling.
I would imagine, you know, but I mean, you know, I know guys that got houses out of, you know, fucking somebody on the side or having a relationship with somebody on the side, you know, and that was on in both arenas, men and women world. And, you know, there was, you know, I can't look back and be like, oh, I was the most moral person, but we do have our own individual moral fabric, you know, that we kind of run on, you know. I mean, I've done things in my life, but, you know, also I look back, and this has come up a lot for me lately, that, you know, now I've been sober for a little bit, and I'm like, you know, I'm reflecting on, you know, what I've done and how I behaved in my time. And, you know, I've done great stuff. I've done good things, you know, and I've been very careful, conscious, and thoughtful about people. But I've also simultaneously been very unloving and very uncaring. You know, not so much strangers. It's always usually the closest people to us that we treat the worst, you know, or people that we're in, you know, in some kind of connection with, and we like get all egoed out, you know, and we're like we just throw our egos around. I mean, being in the industry and being so superficial, like I hated it. I hated working in the modeling industry, but I was good at it. I know, you know, it's like there was just, you know, just the certain things that I practiced in my life helped me a lot, acting and dancing and these kinds of things. They helped me a lot in my career. And that, in turn, you know, when people are like, you're on set and you're around people and they're like, oh my God, you're amazing, you're so incredible, and you walk out the door, you're just that everyday 100-0 Yeah. You know, and the funny thing is, like, I'm like, you know, I was so bad with money, and I made tons of money in my career. But the thing is with that career, because I didn't, you know, and I'm not going to say because, you know, I've been very successful. There are a lot of guys that made way more money than me. They were smarter with their money. They bought houses. They did the smart. I just did not do that. I just thought it was going to always be running in, you know. And I just was like, okay, it's a party. I'm going to take care of my friends because I was good like that. I was giving. I was helpful with my friends that struggled and like that. But I was also very, you know, unconscious and very selfish and very like, well, I'm going to live for today and that's it, period. You know, and I'm not going to think about, and I just, you know, I didn't have that upbringing, you know, where people, I think my grandparents were like the most powerful, you know, voice in that. But I was like, you know, my attitude was always just like, I'm going to do it my way.
When you smoked the first cigarette, what were your thoughts? Like,
I hated it.
The first day.
I hated it.
Just like the drinking.
I couldn't stand it. I hated people that smoked around me. So like to me, just go, okay, give me that cigarette. I'm in, you know. And then like literally, like I'm like, I want to from day one. But that's the level of my addictive behavior and my, you know, whatever self issues I have in my life, and you know, like why I like to punish myself. And like, I mean, I put cigarettes out on myself for years. You know, I wasn't a cutter, but I cut myself at times, you know.
Grade school, middle school, or high school, or more
adult? That was all right after. Like, it was all, for me, I think psychologically, it was about just destroying what I created, you know what I mean? Because I was like, that's all you guys give up about. So, and that's what my life line is about. It's like this. So I literally became kind of the bad boy in the modeling world, you know? And then further on, like, because, you know, in the not too many years after I started in with that, and I'm like, I don't go in lightly. When I like do, it gets real quick and hard and like almost to like killing me, you know. And I had my experience with cocaine. I had that shit with heroin. I had it, you know. And the easy for me, the long term, was alcohol, you know. And that was an easy way. That was the easiest way to just keep myself like a miserable.
After the basically. Cigarette, did you do it again the next day, or you kind of? Yeah. Oh, really?
No, it was like, it was a slow build.
Yeah.
But it was definitely like, even the first time I drank, after that first time, that, you know, I like was like, no, done. That it was a slow build, but like I went in deep. I'm not a blackout drinker, and I'm not a happy drinker. Never have been. I didn't like being around people. I don't like social experiences. I hated it because I would like, I knew a lot of people, went to all sorts of Hollywood parties. Like for the first like 4 or 5 years, I went out a lot, went to the clubs, went to all the parties and all that stuff. And I'd be like kicking it with them, and they're talking about that group, and then I'd be making my rounds and go to them. They're talking about them, and everybody's talking about each other. I'm like, you're all a bunch of you. So I just was like, then I was like, I'm done. And then it was just like me and my tightest homies that I would hang with, and you know, and that's how I rolled. When I would work in the industry, and I didn't hang around it. Like at a certain point, I was like, done. So, I'm not going to hang around with you fools. You're all a bunch of idiots. And I'm going to just lay back, dip in when that job comes in, and then I'm going to get the fuck away from it because you're all a bunch of phony assholes.
There's cigarettes, right? But then that's mind altering, but it's not that devastating and manageable.
Dude,
what was the next
drug? I think cigarettes is the hardest thing I ever had to cope with because it's like the so easy.
But the consequences, it doesn't like, you show up to work still, you still...
Just a physical.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in your health, it completely, it's like for us, like for the self-destructive set, it's the most evil, insidious because it, you know, and you get to be cool healing yours. But, you know, so alcohol was probably the next gen. For me.
How long after that?
And right off the bat.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, kind of cigarettes and alcohol were the first, like me kind of like going, okay. And then I liked, you know, I'm like, I hear people talk about, you know, like, oh, you know, I drank and I was like, oh, I'm like, and I had that epiphany, like, oh, that fixes everything. That's not my experience. My experience is I didn't like it. I hated it, but I couldn't stop doing it. From the get. I think the first time, like, okay, so it was alcohol, and alcohol was always present through my whole life, except for the periods that I got sober, and I had, like, two big chunks of time and a year here and there. But cocaine was, like, a big deal.
When that started happening.
And that was late 80s. I met my first wife. Her name is Mills, and that lady moved some weight.
Like kilo weight?
Wait, not like that, just moved it at the parties. You know, it was like, it was nonstop. And she was a big, big mover. So, yeah. And you know, that was like, it was always there. It was always present. Like my thing around drugs was like, I was a lazy ass. Like I was always around people that had. So I was like, I was that person. It's even shameful to even think of it like that, but I wasn't the guy that like had to go out and cop and get, it was like always there. And so I married her.
Yeah, married the plug.
You know, man, what I'm saying?
You're like the hot girl version, but a dude that marries the plug. You know what I'm saying? Like there's a girl that last night, she married the cocaine dealer. You know, I won't say her name obviously, but like, you're like the hot dude that marries the... I get it. You embody that. Like, if I can meet one of you.
Word. Yeah. So that was it. That was like hardcore crashing, like, you know, but it like that was nonstop. It was hard from the get-go as well. And I, you know, I had like periods and chunks, and I would just go kick it in New York Mills was in New York, and I would go kick it for a couple weeks here and there. and just wreck and then be like, okay, I gotta get back to LA. I can't hang anymore. And like, and it was always like to the point where I felt like I was going to have a heart attack, period, from the get go. Like there was no stop. So, you know, and I like that, that like, for me, like that was, you know, that made me feel gritty and dark and, you know, it made me feel like I could hang on the street and be, feel like I was like, you know, just on the level.
Any consequences, you know, between this time that you were like, whoa, this is kind of bad, or like something, you're like, whoa, did everything, or like any stories you can think about?
There's like, you know, I mean, there's so many stories, but yeah, sure. It's like, you know, like, I mean, there's a funny one, like kind of like, I was up for days with males at the time. It was like, it was late 80s and, We were out at some club. I can't remember. It was the Tunnel or something like that. I was just up for like an entire, like a whole week. I was just wrecked. And it was just cocaine binge like crazy. I just had models all over the place. And it was just like, you know, it wasn't a crazy sex scene, nothing like that. But it was just like ass everywhere. It was just fun. It was just crazy. Like this party, it was always at Mills's. And I got called for a job. I got called to do a very big job. It was for Dolce & Gabbana. And my agents were trying to find me everywhere. They couldn't find me. I would just dip. I would just be like, hey, I'm in town, but you're not going to hear from me for a while. And they'd be like going crazy trying to find me. And they tracked me down that I was at Mills's place. And they're like, dude, you're booked for Dolce & Gabbana. You got to show up right now. And I was like, I was off. I just in the shower, and I run to the set, and it was with Steven Meisel. It was the very first campaign, first men's campaign for Dolce & Gabbana, and I was working. And these are names you may not know: is Christy Turlington and Linda Evangelista. They were super, or in that realm, that time of becoming these super, and you know, I knew who they were, of course. And I'm like, I'm so done. I look like a wet rat, and Steven Meisel sticks his hand out to shake my hand, and I'm like, yeah, what's up, hey man, and I'm like, yeah, fixing my hair, and I'm like, where's the whiskey? And he looks at me like, what the f-?
And I'm like, hey, what's up?
Who are you? Yeah, he wanted to introduce me to Linda. He's like, hey, Tony, meet Linda. And I'm like, yeah, where's the whiskey? Where's the bar? And I fucking just walk right past him. He's like, it's over there. And I fucking just go get a double shot of whiskey. And then I come back and I'm like, hey, what's up? How are you guys doing?
Destroyed opportunity, you know? Or
this,
damage.
No, that... The craziest thing was they accepted it. I worked with a photographer at the time. His name was Lance Stadler, and he would literally buy me a bottle of Jack Daniels. And I mean, this ain't cool, ladies, but he'd be like, you know, and he was not a bad person. He wasn't a person, but he would be like, hey, I got you a bottle of Jack Daniels, and you know, you go get over there and the girls, you know, and he's like an old biker guy, and he just, that's the way it was talked. That's the way it was talked. That was 80s. The talk.
Like early 80s, late
80s? 80s, early 90s. And he'd be like, hey, I got you a bottle of Jack Daniels. Now you can go and rough up the ladies, you know? I'm like, all right, cool. You know, and I mean, and it was never like, it wasn't scummy, but I was good at like, because I did my acting training. So like, I kind of tried to bring that to my modeling stuff, and I would like get into it and get physical. If you see the pictures from that first Dolce & Gabbana, I'm grabbing Linda Evangelista's face. And it's kind of a funny story because Steven's photographing me with Christy Turlington. She was gorgeous. She looked like a deer. Just like this beautiful creature. And I'm like, hey, bitch, come here. Like I was being like a total asshole. And Steven's like, yeah, 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 go for it. And I'm like grabbing her in the face, and I'm like roughing her up. And I'm like, I think I'm like Mr. Actor guy. And I'm like roughing these girls up. And it's funny because I'm working with Christy, and Linda's back there behind Steven, behind the camera, looking at me roughing up her one of her best friends. And and Linda's like, stop doing that. What are you doing? And I'm like, you shut up. And Steven's like, you get in there and put Linda. So the it's a very famous picture. They actually banned it in Rome because it was like kind of brutality towards women. But the photographer's
encouraging it.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, or like, you know, it was acting. It wasn't real. It was play.
How did she feel, though, the person that you were doing it on?
It was heavy. Because I was like, I was going in. I was being like an actor guy.
Was she okay, though?
You know? It was fine.
Cool. Good.
It was fine. But I think maybe she had some feelings around me afterwards, you know? I don't know. But, it was funny. It, like, definitely a different time because that kind of wouldn't fly to me whatsoever, you know? There was a little bit of aggressiveness and stuff like that in my game, how I brought stuff. Because for me, it was like, I couldn't just stand there in a suit and just be like I just couldn't do it. It would have driven me crazy.
You get drunk too.
I would smoke myself. So I would, I'd be drunk on jobs. I'd be coked up on jobs. I was shooting dope for like, I had my dope scene was about a year and a half. And that went super permanent, midnight dark. It went really, really dark. But that was a slow rolling kind of a thing for me. But then when it started banging, it got really heavy.
Who'd you meet to level up to injecting? Because it's not just snorting the line. It's a few notches up.
No, that was, one of my ex-girlfriends. Her name is Dee Dee. Amazing lady. I love her still to this day. And we had like such an amazing experience together, but it was heavy. It got, it was super sexualized, super heavy. When we met, I was sober at the time and I went out partying with Dee Dee. I mean, and I don't think I was like sober in, that thing, in the step kind of jam. I think I was oh, I'm not doing anything for a while. And my friend Luke called me up and he was like, hey, bro, I want you to come over here and meet my girl Dee Dee. She's into you. And I'm like, okay. I'm down. And we're like going at it. Like we're like lining up lines like all night and all over the house. It was like a fuck fest. It was like me and my homie and his girl were like, it was all crazy. But it was like that kicked off. So we were kind of cokeheads for a minute. And then Dee Dee one day, like I started smoking dope and, chasing the dragon thing and snorting it a few times. And then one day she came out with some injectables she had started, and we were living together kind of like off and on. I was like, I had my own place and I would just kick it with her overnights and stuff. And then she was like, I got this stuff. And I'm like, and she was the first one that shot me up. And from that point,
did you enjoy the first shot?
Shit. Me, that was the best thing that I ever did. Like, as far as like get out, don't experience life, don't experience nothing. That was the answer.
And throw up or anything like that?
I think I got that at first. Yeah. And we only did tar. We didn't have powder. Like, it was all L.A. bunk and tar.
Yeah, L.A. tar.
Yeah. And I just, and like right off the bat, it was like the answer. You know what I mean? It's like, for me, like how people talk about alcohol, like heroin was the thing that was like, oh, man, all right. I don't give a button.
How fast was your decline when you started doing heroin?
It literally was like a year in.
That's why I asked.
It went hard fast. Like, I literally was, like, it built to where I was almost ODing every time. Every shot. I was, like, and she was doing speedballs. She started doing speedballs. It didn't start off that way. She started doing speedballs. And this is pre-meth, where people started banging meth. So she was adding that in, and, like, I couldn't take it. So it would be, we would share spoons and share needles and like that. And I would get a hot shot every once in a while. And it would literally, like, I shouldn't be here. Like, so many times I blacked out or, like, went unconscious. So many times I felt like my heart was about to explode. So I was, like, on the brink, like, almost every time I shot up. Like, at a certain point, it just went there. And in the end was like super heavy.
Are you still working though at this time? Yeah, let's talk about that. Like, yeah, what's it like showing like nodding out on set? Like, are they like, it's cool because you still look good or whatever? What's going on?
That was like, yeah. I mean, I was a bit laid back from the business at the time during that year, right? I had just shot a movie called Hustler White. I play a gay hustler so right after that is when my heroin had kicked in. And Yeah, it was. What was your question? Let me see. What was it?
What's it like just being like, nodding out?
Sorry. Like, so
they know something's wrong.
The thing is, it was like, and it was funny because I mentioned to you the other day about the heroin chic thing and the Oprah Winfrey show. We can get into that in a sec, but it's like that kind of mode was happening in the industry at the time, and that was like it was after I want to say, man. Yeah, that was after the like that grunge movement when grunge started happening, and that happened really. It hit hard, and it was kicked off even more so through the fashion industry because it became like such a visual thing, you know, for people like the grunge look and all that. So right after grunge was the heroin chic. You went from this like stylized, like dirty, destroyed look into a destroyed look, you know. So, it was just a thing. You try to, right? You try, like, when you're drunk, you're like, oh, people don't know I'm drunk. You're not even conscious. Like, people can smell that on you. You're a junkie. People know you're a junkie. It was like the sexual stuff, right? They just ignored it. They were just like, oh, well, okay. You look amazing, so we'll take pictures of you. Reinforce your already dark eye, you know, your eye sockets, your sunken eye sockets, and your dark, you know, the shadows under your eyes.
Unintentionally, where acting became
more. They glorified it, really, right? I mean, they're just like, okay, you're skinny and sucked up, and you're like white skin with blue veins sticking out everywhere, and you look like you're just a wreck. And it was just became a thing. It became a look for a while. And it started with the grunge thing, with that, because, you know, with Kurt Cobain and like all that. That's where that started, like, becoming fashion and fashionable, right? That look. And then, you know, and people, it's almost like, you know, I mean, we could slip into the Oprah Winfrey show, which was dog trash, and she's a piece of whatever, and that's just my opinion. But because, and I say that for a reason, because she didn't give up about listening to my story. Like, I was trying to come, you know, what they were trying to do was pin it on. And reflection, rightly so, to some extent. But they were trying to pin it. Like, I was on the show with my agent, Todd. And they were trying to, like, pin what my demise, my use of heroin on him. And it's like, it wasn't him. He had nothing to do with it. I was outside of the industry. And if you're a junkie, you're not, you know, I mean, there were probably people in the industry, there were agents and people that were, of course, on heroin. It was a thing then, you know, definite thing. In that time, it was like heroin was a big deal. And a lot of people were on it. A lot of people were on it in the industry.
What was she asking? Like, what questions and like?
Just, I think it was just all implying and implicating the fashion industry. They were trying to have a target, right? Because, you know, the people need to know. We have to have a target that we can attack and put this spin on and this blame on. How about the trafficking of that drug into our country? How about putting it on them? And my point was, like, when I was coming at it, and I think I was sober at the when I did the show, and it was like, you know, this comes from family, this comes from our society, this comes from, it's a problem. It's a problem. It's not, you're not going to just pinpoint some aspect of a person's life and say, oh, that's why that exists. You know, yeah, fashion glamorized that, but guess what? That was a part, that's just a part and parcel of the fact it was an advertising industry that was utilizing that. So it's bigger. There's more components to that problem, and you can't just pinpoint it on one thing.
Were the questions given to you beforehand?
No.
Wow.
Actually, no. It wasn't even that. It was like there were several. There were other models there, and just prior to that, a famous photographer's brother had OD'd and died, and his brother, I think, was an artist. I'm not sure, but you know, he was quite a. I don't know if I should say it or not, but his Mario Sorrenti's younger brother had passed away from an OD, and the sister, Mario's, and the brother, I can't remember the brother's name, but and the sister was on the show and talking about, you know, this thing. It'd be interesting to find the clip again. I think I watched it one time and was like, that's, you know, I just kind of like blew it off. But you know, I don't, you know, it's like, it's to me, it was all hype. you know? And it wasn't about, you know, any kind of solution, like, how do you help kids that are up, you know? And they were saying, like, the agents were a part of, like, you know, like, kind of closing their eyes to it and just saying, oh, get out there and do the, do your thing and just show up. And that, I don't, you just can't put it all on that. Right. You know what I mean? It's like, you have a problem, you have a, you want to address it, then think about some solutions around this and not just pointing fingers,
and
you know.
A year and a half, you plummeted in just a year and a half.
Yeah.
Where were you in a year and a half?
I was
homeless or, like, does it?
No, know? I never, you know, I mean, you know, I felt homeless many times in my life, but.
Yeah. A year and a half, where were you?
I was living in, basically between Echo Park and Silver Lake. I was on, I think it was on Mitchell Terrena or something like that. I can't remember. Just right down the way in Echo Park area. I was on Lucille, that's right. And some little house out there. And, you know, we had, Dee Dee had her little son and, with us. And that's kind of why I feel like it went super permanent midnight and dark, because we became so fully immersed in our addiction. And we had a little kid there with us. We had a little baby there with us. And it was just, you know, and that neglect and that kind of, you know, thing for a little thing to have to experience.
I think
maybe one.
Oh, man.
Maybe not even one. Yeah. So he's a little guy. And, you know, God bless. He's like, you know, Dee Dee's doing really well and sober these days. Rocco was the little guy, and he's sober. He went through his turmoil and stuff like that, and he got sober as well today. So that's that. I mean, you know, I'm fucking grateful for that. You know, that's, it's such a heavy thing. It's like, it's even hard for my mind to kind of go back to that, because it got so ugly. We were, you know, at one point, like, I was literally ODing, and I had an out of body experience, right? And I feel like I'm floating, I'm like going. It felt like, you know, like I had the pounding chest, and all of a sudden it just went quiet, and I felt like I was outside of my body. And I hear Rocco. This is a really heavy thing. And I hear Rocco, and he's in the hallway, and he's banging on the bathroom door, and his mom is unconscious, OD'd in the bathroom, laying on the floor. And I open the door, and Rocco's there with me, and he's screaming and crying. And I just run down the room and throw him in his bedroom. And then I go to work trying to revive her. So I'm like pushing on her chest, and I'm trying to bring her back. And yeah, it's grim. But she came too. I threw her in the bathtub, you know, got her fucking the cold water, hot water. I was just trying to do everything to get her out, get her up back. And it's so crazy, because like there's music playing, and it was the Cranberries, and it was so wild because just music was playing all day, and it was the Cranberries, and it was that song. I think it's Hollywood is the song, but maybe not. It's the one about heroin. It's about the one about heroin addiction.
While it's happening,
bro. And I'm like, and I literally like go, like, she's kind of comes back off, and I'm running to the living room to turn the song off. And I don't know why that was my impulse, but I turn around to go back to the, and there's the LA Weekly is sitting on the table, and it's turned to, it's on a page. So I think it was on the back page of the magazine, the newspaper, right? And it's like, kick heroin, no withdrawals. And I'm like, yeah. And I immediately call the number, and it goes straight to somebody in Beverly Hills. And I talk to him, like, listen, my girl just OD'd. I feel like I'm about to die. We need help. And he's like, don't worry, we'll get you. He's like, do you have such and such money? And I'm like, yeah. And I just had done this big job. BND had gone and done this big job. They gave me $22,000 in cash in an envelope at the end of the job. And I had some of that money left, and it was like I had exactly the amount. It was like $10,000 or something like that they needed. That we took a train the next day to Mexico, and we did a it was considered how they describe it, a forced with. So I can't remember what the chemicals were, but they strap you onto a gurney. I went first. They strap you onto a gurney. They strap you down and you're IV'd on both arms and you are unconscious. So one of them is to knock your ass out and one of them is basically to rip the opiates off of your cells. And it's gnarly. They have to knock you out because you, your body goes through
super wrecking, super convulsions. It's like, a ghetto-ass, dirty Narcan.
It was crazy, bro. It almost killed me. Literally, there, like, you almost died on the table. It must have been, like, 86, 87. No, sorry. 96, 97.
Still, I mean, Narcan is just up your nose, and you're doing... That's crazy,
dude,
man.
Dude, so get this. So it almost killed me. They're like, you almost died, one. So I'm done with my...
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like in the bed, like just going, doing my recoup right after it. And she's going in to get her done. And he's like, comes in, he's like, you know, they give me like some orange juice and a piece of white bread to eat. And they're like, hey, do you want to watch her kick? And I'm like, are you kidding me? And they're like, and I'm like, all right. So I go in, right? And she's all strapped down. She's all IV'd up. And I'm like, what do you need the straps for? Because I didn't know what. And they're like, oh, that's to keep you from poking your own eyes out. Or
that's some dark humor, dude. Goddamn.
They're like, that's so you don't break bones. Poke your own eyes out. Fuck. Yeah, dude. So I'm like, fuck yeah, I want to watch this shit. And it was insane, bro. Just the she was lifting off the table. Like her body was just, it was insane. It was insane. And then they put me so it's at a resort. It's like right next to a resort where this hospital was, right? And then they put you in this resort right on the beach. And I'm like, we're like sitting on the, at the pool. I'm like all covered up in a blanket. And I'm just like sweating bullets. I was like, the whole morning I was pissing and vomiting
yourself
all over. Yeah, all over myself in the bed.
Yeah.
And she cleaned me up and I was like, and we went outside and I'm like, I think I'm dying here, dude. And she's like, okay, I'm like, you gotta call them. I'm dying. And she calls the doctor. They get me back in there, and they have to vitamin me up and all the whole. So again, they're like, you know, I was about to go out, and then, you know, we were there for another night. I chilled out. Chilled out is not really the word.
What is it?
I felt like I was dragged under a truck.
Definitely not chilled.
Dude, I felt there. It was not. There was no withdrawal. That was a lie. Because, like, for 10 days, I felt like there was a truck dragging me down the street.
Was it a scam or did it really actually benefit?
I mean, I got clean.
Okay, sure.
You know? Yeah. But I was in so much pain, and it slowly, like, tapered down. But it was straight up kicking. It was straight up, I was dead. And it was like every hair hurt. It was insane. So like, you fuck you guys. and so we get back, I'm in agony, and she's like, I'm copping, bro. And I'm like, what? And so I felt like I was hit by a truck. She's dancing. She's like, oh man, I feel great.
And
I'm
good on her.
Dude. She just did. She's a cockroach. She didn't feel shit. It didn't hurt her. It hurt me. She's just a straight cockroach. Just didn't feel nothing. It was like, she's like, I'm cool. My toes are tapping. I'm like, and we got back. She's like, I'm done. I'm like, I'm out of here. I'm like, you dude, if you get hot, if you get loaded, I'm gone. And she's like, late. And so she hooked up with homie, started doing some dirty stuff, and I'm not gonna go there with that. But you know, God bless her. She like came through and got herself straightened out after that. But she went through some hard after that. I ended up going and living with my homie that does the jewelry and stuff, and I got clean. But like I knew like I've hit the wall with heroin, like you know be. I don't know. I mean, it was like, to me, it was like that this is the escape. But then at that point, I was like, I just don't want to be the walking dead anymore. You know, I didn't want to, you know, and I was like, and you know, I don't think the fact that it almost killed me was why. I was just like, oh, did my shit go off?
Yeah, I think. I don't want you to get a ticket.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
No. Do you see it on your phone?
Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, my shit.
Close?
Was that an hour?
Yeah, dude, you got a lot to say. Hey, you want to go handle it and come back?
Yeah.
This is cool. Just, I don't want you to get a $7 ticket.
Like, all right. Do you need to stop shit?
I'll post-produce it. All right. For sure. Dude, that's just cockroach. Dude.
Hey, man, I'm a cockroach, too. There's no diss there.
Yeah, for sure. Just leave the door unlocked and then come back.
Okay, there's a...
what's up?
Do I need the code?
Yeah.
3, 3, 4, 5. Oh, you have a thing up.
Whoa. You know, it's like you can have this life that looks like it's like super luxurious, like full life where you can get laid at any time. You know, you're having fun at like luxurious places. It looks like from outside you're on top of the world, but really you're suffering. It's like you never know what somebody's going through, you know. So people that are rich, I mean, it's all relative. Or people that are like famous, it's like it's all relative. Or people that are, you know, Anthony, Tony Ward is wild. Come on in.
Yeah, come on.
Did you get
it? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry, bro.
No, let me start it off.
Which?
Just go there to the left and start right hand side.
Okay. Such a dope setup.
Thanks, man.
Sorry for the little weak.
No worries, man.
Yeah, thanks for. Let's go into it.
All right.
Cool. Let's go.
Another hour?
Yeah. Whatever you want to get.
Yeah, let's go. Tables back on.
One time I did a radio, like I was in rehab in so I dated Madonna.
Really?
Back in the early 80s. So I did Madonna's Cherish video back in the day. I play a merman. So we met in the 80s around. And
still on heroin?
No. That was just when the night that we hooked up, I was on a whole bottle of whiskey and ecstasy and whatever else I was on. I don't know.
90s.
Weed. Yeah, this was 90. 89, 90.
Good ecstasy.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like I was on.
Wait.
Paranoid is, but I was on.
Let's go back. She says, peace, I'd rather do dope than kick it with you. And then what's your friend that has the jewelry on his hand?
Oh, Justin Davis.
Yeah.
He's an ex-junkie, right? So what was the question, though?
So you were at his house. He said, hey, come on. It's cool. Come by.
Right. So, he helped me get sober at that time. And that's when I met Christina. So it was like my early days of sobriety. Yeah, he just like, he was from the Andy Warhol era, super crazy freak kind of guy. Really, really good homie of mine. And, you know, let me crash on his couch for a while. And then I ended up living in a garage, my friend's garage, for a few months. And had my first trip to Japan at that time.
How long did you stay sober for that stint?
I think that was one of my short... I think it was like 7-8 months. Maybe a year.
Where did you relapse? Do you remember that time? Like where you were, what you were feeling, what was going on?
I'm trying to remember. See, that's where it gets a little bit foggy. Like literally I had about 6 years of sobriety one time. I had 4 years of sobriety one time. And I don't know. I can't remember how that fell in there. And a year here, 7 months there or something like that. So I had a few chunks.
This one's 6 months.
This one, I think the first time I got sober, Madonna, the reason I mentioned Madonna was that she put me in my first rehab. She put me in both my rehabs. So one was in Marina Del Rey was the first one. It was the Exodus. I think it was Exodus. And then I went to, and it's an interesting story around that, you know, funny one. So that was for really just like kind of doing a little bit of coke at the time and a little bit. It was like in that time when I was just becoming, you know, going towards being a drug addict. I wasn't there. It was mostly alcohol at that time. And, you know, I had met Madonna. We got real close. We were tight. And we lived together for about 6 months. And I had an apartment, and she was like, okay, I'm going to go on tour and support this movie. She did this movie, Truth or Dare. That's when we met, when they were editing Truth or Dare. And I moved back into my place, and I started going off the wheels because she was like, okay, we're not done, but you ain't going on tour with me, and I'm going to go do this thing, and I'm going to anybody I want to be, so peace out later.
And you pay for the rehab.
Yeah, but she put me in my first rehab, and I think that was about 7-8 months, I guess.
What'd you do when you got out of there?
And when I went out, like, honestly, don't remember exactly when I went out then, and like what it was.
What happened when you left the rehab? What'd you do?
Well, so that's what I was gonna say. I was in there for my little drug use and a little bit of drinking. I was getting shakes, so I was drinking at the time, and I was drinking hard liquor. I wasn't a beer drinker at that time. I was definitely having the morning shakes and all that, you know, and I just depressed because she's like, you know, a few later,
yeah,
you know,
but she put
me in rehab,
yeah.
You know, and, you know, and it's like, we're not done. So she was like keeping that fishing line on me in a way, like, we're not done, but I'm going to off for a year. And that's when I got really bad, and I became an artist when I was in, I started painting.
After leaving the rehab?
No, in the rehab.
Oh, cool.
In the rehab, my agent bought me paints and some canvases and stuff like that, and I started painting. And my roommate was Dave Navarro, right when I was, because I was graduating from my rehab, and Dave became my roommate the last week I was in rehab. And I was just like, and his chick was sneaking dope into him and like that. And he's like getting high in the room and shit. No. But he was a cool cat. And I was like, oh, Jane's Addiction, you're the shit. And we would like sit and kick it out and talk and stuff. And he's out of his mind, drunk, like a high. And, but he's Dave Navarro. So they're, of course, he's paying them money. So letting him in. And he was the first junkie that I knew that was in my face. And I'm like, you're coolest, dude. On my graduation night in the, you know, where we're like, you know, I passed my course, I have my certificate. And in my head, I'm like, I'm doing dope. Fuck that shit.
Wait, I'm gonna do dope.
Yeah. Thanks for everything. I'm doing dope. And that's when I started like, just like, oh, how do I get this shit?
So you realized when you left.
No, I think it took a little bit.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, no, I lasted like, I lasted about 7-8 months.
Oh,
so, cool. Yeah, so I had, and actually Madonna, she got me into the Twin Towers and not the jail, the fucking, the Twin Towers in Santa Monica. And it's a really dope apartment complex out there, like super high end, you know, flossy flush. And she got me an apartment in there, and I was such a whack job. And I was working with these guys. We were all sober at the time, and one of them was my best friend, Estevan, and we worked with this design group. And so I was kind of dropped into physical labor. I didn't go back to doing modeling stuff. I was doing like designing restaurants and tables and
yeah,
and it's all with like aerospace materials and like that. Was dope. It was a dope
funded
job.
By Madonna,
or huh?
Was it funded by her?
No. This was just something I like up out cool. Right after I got out of rehab.
Yeah.
So I must have went out when I was working with these guys. There would be towards the end of me working with those guys, and I think that lasted. Yeah, it was about like 7-8 months that I stayed sober. But and I can't remember who it was. It was just there was always a cast of wacko characters coming in and out of that place, and the guys that I was some of the two head guys that we were working with were up guys. So God bless them, but they were, you know, drunks and pill poppers and shit like that. So I was just like, somehow I just started getting loaded again. I don't even remember how it happened. I didn't get it. You know what I mean? I kind of held out. And then an old girlfriend. So the first person I smoked dope with was my first girlfriend in L.A. Her name was Rosetta. And I, you know, we ran into each other out of some club or something like that one night. And I'm like, you know, what's up, baby? And she was all, I'm like, what are you on? And she's like, I smoke dope now. And I'm like, all right. I'm gonna have to try that sometime. And then that's how that like smoking started up with me. Yeah, and that just kicked that off.
So what's going on after that then? Next rehab?
No, yeah. What am I saying? Yeah. I was, that went on for a little bit. It wasn't that long, I don't think. And then, you know, of that kind of that smoke out time, because I hadn't started shooting yet. I think I was working a little bit with modeling stuff here and there. I was after I left that job with the design group, designing, right? I started working with this painter who did murals and stuff. So we would go out to Malibu, like rich folks' houses, and paint murals on their walls and stuff like that. So I was doing that with him, and the guy was a real sweetheart, and he had a boyfriend. He lived up in the hills. He's like, my house is empty. You can take it. So I took his place, and I was really into painting at the time. Through the rehab, I just really got, like, I found something that I loved, and I could, like, vomit my thoughts and feelings onto a canvas, and I was like, so that was really golden for me. And I just slowly started slipping away from the mural. Like, he was like, hey, you know, we're starting this new job. Can you show up? And he was such a stoner. He didn't give a shit if I showed up or not. So, you know, I just started slowly slipping away, and Rosetta started coming over more often, and we were smoking, and I was just starting to smoke dope all the time. And, and then I called Madonna again.
Yeah.
And she had come off a tour or whatever. And,
what's she like?
And
funny, bubbly, serious.
Fucking out of her mind. No, she was amazing. Like, you know, we had, it was a real deal relationship. It was super love. I think we both really loved each other. There was some really super deep connection in it. But at that time, she was probably one of the most known and powerful women in the industry, in the music industry, and, you know, one of the most well-known women in the world. And then, you know, little dumbass me, you know, and like kind of really naive and didn't know that level of stuff. And, you know, I had a lot of really cool experiences with this person. And you know.
Why do you think she liked you so much? I mean, like, that's a negative thing. I'm just
that's,
saying, like...
No, and it's not negative. It's like, I mean...
she's Madonna.
I think she liked Bad Boys. So, you know, I think that was, like, you know, that was a persona that I had at the time. And on the external aspect, it was, you know, for, you know, she was very visual, like, you know, and was impressed maybe with that, you know, maybe a toxic person. She was always very supportive of people, like her brother, Christopher. I think she helped him out a lot with rehabs, and some of her other brothers had some, you know, abuse issues. And she was very supportive of people, family, as well as friends that maybe had problems. And I was one of them, and she loved and cared about me, and she tried to be there and help me, you know, but it's like, but, you know, to me, it's like we're afflicted and we're crippled by that. If you're held and grabbed by an addiction, you know, whatever that substance may be, you know, or whatever that kind of like extreme, like if you have sex and or gambling addiction, it's a real thing and it's very, very powerful and it's your life over. And I think she liked those wounded souls and those wounded people, you know, but maybe she was wise enough to like keep some like distance from that as well in the personal way. But
for you though,
you know, it was super powerful. What, you know, what's funny about my relationship with her was that, it was something that wasn't like, oh, that's Madonna, because I saw her first on MTV when MTV just cracked on the scene in the world, right? She was one of the first artists that were in that. So when I saw her, I'm like, oh, like I knew that person. I knew that I was going to be with that person someday, which is crazy because I was, you know, it was prior to even, you know, I was still living in San Jose at the time when that happened. And I can't remember the year, you know, when MTV, in 80, I don't know when that, I can't remember the year when MTV started up, but it's like, it was early 80s. And, but I had that sense. I always had that sense. And the funny thing, I talked about this interview I did with Omar the other day, is that she wrote me this, well, maybe I didn't, but she wrote me this long letter after I went to my second rehab, and it was a big goodbye letter. It was basically like, you know, it's time, we've gone our own way, you know, that we go our own way now. I'll always love you, you know, it's real what we have together, but it's time for us to move. You know, I can't just love one person. I need to spread the love, basically. And I'm like, okay. And, you know, and that was super painful, you know, just on the emotional connective, you know, when you think you're in love with somebody and, you know, you have no idea what love is or how to love people or care about people, but you think you're in love with somebody and it's super powerful. And what she said, what was really funny in the letter was, you know, I went to my psychic and she had some serious psychics that she went to that she every once in a while she would go in and like and had some super psychic that she researched out and found that she went to and said that she was my mother in a past life. And that's a part of her reasoning why we couldn't be. And I'm like, okay.
You're Madonna's mother. Damn, you're Madonna's mom.
I'm Madonna's mom. Yeah. No, that she was my mother in a past life.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah, cool.
I mean, but that flip would be really hilarious. That was a hard nut to swallow.
Yeah.
For real.
Did you go deeper on the drugs after that?
Yeah.
Is that for the solution?
Yeah, no, that's when it kicked off, you know. It took me a few years that I was I think that it was like I lived with that kind of like the pain of that, you know, the pain of like a break of a relationship and something that I thought was real true love and stuff. And that affected how I was going to treat other relationships and women in my life because of how that, you know, how, because like after that experience with her and that letter that I got from her, I was like, I'm never going to love anybody ever again. Like I told myself, I was like, okay, I get it. You got to spread the love then. You got to love everybody. For me, like at that time, I was like, oh, okay. There's no such thing as being in love. In love is throw in front of love and that means something. And so what I thought was like, oh, you gave me the key. You just made me understand that that's just some wording that we all buy and we get crippled by. You know, for me, being in love was just being a trippy way to look at it, but that's how I went out. And, you know, and of course, like coping with that, the use and abuse got fucking way deeper. And then after that, it was when, you know, I went through the whole thing. Yeah.
So how close was that to your, what happened in this last sobriety? What was your bottom line?
Yeah, that was, it's wild. Because,
let's go back. You relapsed and you thought, okay, I'll come back. And it was fucking years.
14.
14.
Give or take about 14.
No, but please talk about that. Yeah. What was your mindset?
Yeah, it's wild because, you know, they say that, you know, you're if you have, or, you know, whatever, this, you know, insanity or and lack of, you know, some kind of power that's greater than yourself, you like, you know, your disease is out there doing push-ups and it's getting crazy, you know, and when you jump back out, you're going to go to hell and you're going to go straight back to where you were at the level you were. So for me, I didn't go back to using dope. Thank God. Thank God I didn't end up going back. I fixed on a relationship. So I met my second wife, which was for real. I was in Japan. I was my friend Justin, the jewelry designer, friend of mine. And, you know, and it just happenstance, I see, you know, this naked Japanese girl on a stage and it hits me like a ton of bricks. I'm like, oh, that's the mother of my children. Like immediately, that was my crystallization. Like, and I wasn't going at, like, I was at some party for my friend Justin, and everybody's like, oh, let's go to this strip club in Roppongi. And I'm like, nah, I'm good. I just want to go home. And they're like, nah, come on, let's go. We're going to introduce you to some, you know, famous rock stars and some tattoo artists and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh. So I go. And literally, like, I'm like, you know, order a drink. And I'm like not really paying attention, talking to my friends. And this, you know, amazing looking creature naked walking on a stage. And I'm like double taking. And I couldn't stop staring at her. And I was like, oh, like in my head, I was like, I'm going to marry that. Like, I knew it.
So what did you mean?
She didn't speak a word of English.
Okay, yeah.
And we just slowly, like, we just you know, I didn't, I said, you know, she sat on my lap, gave me a lap dance or something, you know, with my future wife. Yeah. And then, and I was, you know, I felt like, kind of like, what? This is strange. And then, and we couldn't talk, and I didn't, and then I was like, I said goodnight. And then like 2 weeks went by, and I'm like, I gotta go, something, I gotta go see that chick. So I went back, and then I moved in with her that night. Like, I literally, I'm like, hey, what's up? Like, you want to hang out after you get off? And
how'd she understand that?
Dude, we did sign language. No, it was, like, yeah. We didn't have anybody to, like, well, maybe I might have had a friend with me, actually, that kind of translated a bit. I had a couple of good knees, so it must have been that. But I literally went to her house, we had sex, and I didn't leave for, like, 2 months. I literally moved in with her like that. That's because that's how I've enrolled, I guess.
You got married in Japan?
No. We conceived the child.
Oh, you have a kid?
Pretty right off the bat. No, sorry. Conceived. We got pregnant. She got pregnant. And then the last month I was like, I have to leave. She got pregnant literally just before I'm leaving, and I met my friend, my homie Takaho's, and he's giving me a tattoo, and he's giving her a tattoo, and she goes to the bathroom, and she has a miscarriage, and I'm like, oh, because she was like, okay, we're like, we're gonna do this, right? And I'm like, yeah, we're gonna do this, not being able to each other, and that happened, and I went into the bathroom, I got on my knees, I'm like, so I left Japan. Not intending to keep a thing with her, I was like, yeah, you know, maybe you can come out to LA sometime. And literally a month later, she's like, I can't deal with this. I want to be with you. And I'm like, yeah, but, and I was just reading for a movie at the time called American History X. I was like, it was between me and Ed Norton, the job to get the movie. And I was like all fired up on myself, you know, like, oh, I'm about to do a big movie. And she's like, you keep ignoring my phone call, but I'm coming. I'll see you in like 3 days. I'm like, what? And she came, and so I'm like, okay, whatever, cool. She came. She got pregnant in the first week, and that was my.
You have a son.
Yeah, I have 4 kids. So I have 3 with Shinobu. I have 3. I have Tora, Lily, and Ruby. My Shinobu. And I have 1 son in London.
The whole time you're getting loaded.
At that time I wasn't loaded. At that time I was sober.
You seem functional, yeah.
Yeah. So I mean I was trying, you know.
What made you
there are times though? When I would try. Like I was sober for a good chunk of time. This is how it happened. So Shinobu, like, I'm such a dickhead, dude. So my ex-wife Shinobu, she stayed here for 7 months in the pregnancy. So she got pregnant in the first week. She stayed for 7 months. She stayed over the limit, right? So she stayed over the time, and they were like, they were sending letters like, you need to get out, you know, otherwise you're never going to be able to come back to America. So she went back in the 7th or 8th month of the pregnancy, and she had my son in Japan. And so we didn't get married. I was married to my first wife, Mills, still. I just sat on that, like, because, like, yeah, whatever, that marriage fizzled out and went weird. I let that stand. I was married for 10 years and not married. So I couldn't get married to Shinobu. So she went back to Japan, finished out the pregnancy there. And meanwhile, I was just being a cad. I was just being a dickhead. And, and that's when, I think when she left is when I started getting loaded again. And I was just doing the dirty. And I was like trying to kick off a photography career. I was started taking pictures. Me and a buddy of mine made a movie. We directed a movie together, a thing that nobody's ever seen. We never ended up being.
Did you think because of alcohol it's okay because I'm not doing heroin? Was that your thought?
I think, yeah. I mean, you know.
Because you want to do what you want to do,
though. I'm the ease person. It's like whatever's the easiest, you know. I think because, like, heroin was such a all-encompassing, like, core fiber
kind of world.
High kind of thing. like to me, drinking was just like, it was nothing. It was nothing to me. It didn't, you know, I could drink a lot and it didn't, I didn't get sick from drinking. I didn't throw up from drinking. I could just pound drinks and I didn't give up.
So what was the bottom then to come back?
This time, you know, the big chunks of sobriety and, you know, I realized like one of the things that was the most clear to me in my bottom this time was that I felt no hope. I felt empty. I felt like happiness and joy was out of my life, out of reach for my life anymore. And I'm like, fuck am I, why even keep doing this? You know? And, and I couldn't stop drinking. I mean, I didn't destroy myself with actual use, but the bottom was just the spiritual void, the void of it, the black hole in my heart. And the first time in my life that I seriously like was like, it would be way better for my kids because, you know, they didn't give a f- about, now I'm, you know, this is starting to change in my life. You know, I didn't give a f- about what anybody else thought or felt or, and, but I cared what my, and thought about me. And, my oldest daughter, Lily, is basically my Eskimo, you know, to get my, start looking at getting my shit back
what'd
together,
you do?
Thinking there was some hope. She sent me a podcast. I don't remember the guy's name, but, it was a podcast, that had this convict who is an ex-abuser and you know, criminal, and he turned his life around, got sober, and had a super powerful message. And I'd been thinking, I'm like, I know I'm going to end up back, because the way I'm feeling, I know I'm going to end up back in AA, but I don't want to. And she sends me out of the blue. She's like, you know, Pops, I love you, but I don't respect you. I don't, you know, I'm like, I want to be proud of you someday, and I'm not. And I was like, ooh, like, you know, and she's like, listen to this and, you know, check this out. And I listened to this and I started fucking crying. I'm like bawling and I'm listening to it on mushrooms. I'm tripping on mushrooms and I'm and drinking and listening to this podcast. And like, it's only like an hour long podcast and it's a conversation between the interviewer and the guy.
Yeah.
And he just dropped some dimes and he's like, you know, think about like, how would you want your, yeah. And it was so in line with what she said to me about not being proud of me. And it's like, someday I'd like to, you know, not just, you know, love you because you're my dad. I'd like to have a purpose and reason to, you know, and that was, but this guy, you know, his, one of the messages he says was like, you know, write your own, what do they call it? When you, at a funeral, when you,
eulogy,
write your own eulogy. And it's not, you know, what would you think? It's not what you want. What would you want to hear from other people about you? And then they hit me so strong because everybody would be like, well, he is just a drunk drug addict piece of shit. You know, and it just hit me really hard, you know, and I was just, you know, I just lost it. And I'm like, you know, that's not, you know, it really hit me. It's like, that's not what I want to leave behind, you know? And it's like, I have a career. I have a thing where people have like this facade of who I am. And I lived that facade for a really, really, like my whole life. I just lived this external thing, this external life. But I didn't, you know, the people closest to you really know what's up with you and who you are.
That's more painful because Everyone thinks this and really what's going on is like not that.
Yeah, like super like, I mean, doing this, talking, like being, you know, I've done interviews like from really early on in my career and especially after I dated somebody so famous, right? They're like, oh, what do you think? And they're always wanting to know about my relationship with that person, not giving up like you don't want to know nothing about me. You want to know what it's like to her. You know, it's like, it's so stupid. Like the, you know, people are like so, you know, superficial, like in real, we're superficial. You know, we can be so superficial about ourselves. We create, to me, like I created an identity, my ego superpowered my identity. And that's a complete facade. Like, I have to, that's a safety mechanism for me my whole life. And come to find out that doesn't work, because once you penetrate that little, that thin shell, you're just a mess underneath all that, you know? And, you know, and the difference, step? And the difference of that, you know, of like between this kind of sobriety and what it was before, I think was just like the realization that I couldn't ask for help, and I didn't know I needed help. I didn't know I needed to ask for help and have a community of people that are like-minded, that have that feeling like I, that feel like I feel, and that relate and understand, and having that kind of a support that's super vital, because our world, the way we're just like in the American way is like, we're pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. We're just going to grunt through this thing. We're going to only think of ourselves and getting ahead and getting rich and whatever, like being known or something like that. And it's also nothing. It's so weightless, you know, but you know, we hold on to that things like it has weight, and that weight that we think it is weighs us, is just, it becomes too tremendous. And it's not, you don't even have to be an abuser of any kind of a substance. You can kind of alluded to before. It's like if you obsess on that will cripple you, and if you obsess, and you know, and one has to, like, we have to look at ourselves and find out why, and what are we, why, and why. What is the cause of my obsession towards that and that discovery?
After your trip, you came down. What was your next step?
I think that it was like,
where'd you go?
Well, yeah. I mean, I went to this clubhouse. And, well, what happened was, like, I just had that kind of realization. It's like, okay, you know, I know where to go. I know what I got to do. It's not what I want to do, but I know that from past experience. Thank God that seeped in enough to just go, okay, there is a safe house, or there is a safety boat, you know, that few people get to find and truly live in that space, live in that place where they're like, okay, you know, this is going to be a journey, or this is going to be something that I'm going to have to, like, I'm going to have to stay on this boat.
Did you go to rehab, or did you?
I didn't rehab. I'm in sober living right now.
I mean, like, when you were.
But go ahead.
Go ahead. Like, so, like, you had the mushroom trip. You heard the tape from your daughter. Like, it's so emotional. Yeah. Next day, you're like, I got to do this. But yeah. What would you just go to again, or were you like?
I went to this one place. It was just funny because it was super funny because my sober date is April 1st, April Fool's Day, 23, and it's. This is the kind of, like, I proved it to myself, and it's so funny because I went to this one clubhouse. I'm like, it was a very small, and, you know, it's just a handful of, you know, older guys and a couple of young, like, skater punks, and me and my friend Erica, so that I was living with my friend, and we were getting sober together. You know, not together, I knew for me, I was doing it for me. We came along for this ride, and God bless her, she's hanging in there. But it's like, the alcoholic I am is like, I went to them, they asked me to read chapter 5, from the reading from AA literature, and I was just like, after, like, as soon as I got to this, I just started bawling, and I couldn't even finish reading. It took me like 15 minutes to get to the through. It was crazy. I was just losing it. Just every word was hitting me like a hammer, you know, in the heart. And I was like, fuck, that was crazy. And then, you know, shared a little bit of, you know, it's all, like, to me, is like vapor right now. But right after the meet, like, even before the ending of the, I'm like, I'm going to have a Bloody Mary right after the, like, our favorite place was right down the street. And I'm like, and I say to Erica after we get out of the meeting, I'm like, let's go get a Bloody Mary. She's like, really? And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, I decided at the end of the, I'm like, I decided April Fool's Day is going to be the thing, because that's sobriety day.
So you didn't get a Red Mary, Bloody Mary?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, we went we went to our favorite spot, got our Bloody Mary, watched some sports on the thing, and then, you know, and I didn't go crazy. It wasn't over the top. Because I was determined, I was like, yeah, that, it's just not today. Not the 28th of February. Yeah. I'm like, it's going to be April Fool's Day. It's going to be the first. It has to be. So I was like, yay, two more days of drinking. You know, that's the way my, you know, alcoholic thinking is. So I'm going to control this shit. You know?
What's going on now with you?
Right now, I'm in sober living. I'm with my my younger brother. He's he's been living rough for the past, you know, like 6 years. And he, you know, he's a feral cat. And he's put himself in us for a long time. For years, he has seizures now. He's 4 years younger than me. So you ask me what I'm doing. I pulled him into this sober living with me, and you know, he's I'm coming to these terms at this point where I'm learning how to like let other people have their own journey, realizing like I don't control, and that's not my duty or my job is to make sure everybody else is okay, which is a trippy thing because, and that's where that term, you know, in the program here is it's a selfish program. So yeah, it is. On the level of like, I have to like really come to terms with like what I'm doing is I need to surrender myself and have a faith in something else that will just allow me to you know, be in a space where I can like be willing to accept suggestion, the tools that are there to work with to live as a person. And it's, you know, and that's a challenge because like I'm a perfectionist. I want everything to be perfect in my world. I want me to be perfect. I want, you know, the people in my lives to be perfect. And in some ways, you know, it's not like, it is controlling. It's total control. And letting go of that kind of, you know, how you perceive and, you know, your paradigm and how you deal with life and deal with other people, you know, and being able to like, you know, let go of yourself and your thoughts and how you think should be and how they should work out, you know. You know, funny saying that's let go and let God. What is it? Like, it's funny. Just like knowing that it's letting go of something that you've been holding on to your entire life, you know? And that there's freedom in letting go of yourself and know and thinking that you know. Like, I'm not a dumb guy. I'm smart to some extent. You know, I have wisdom. I understand myself and I think I understand life a little bit, but none of that will keep me from just none of what I think I know. Even if like, I mean, I've been a spiritual searcher my whole life. I knew even very young, it's like, okay, the man written books of God and everything that came from man, that's not God. And I don't know what God is. And I don't know. And I would never, you know, claim that I do know, but I think that there's some energy. I think there's some energetic force that keeps us all, you know, animated beings. Otherwise, we'd be dead beings, you know. And I don't think we are that. I think we are these, you know, energetic. If that spark left us, then we die. We're done.
So,
you know, and yeah, you're gonna.
Let me ask a question. Like, we're gonna close up. So, like. What would you tell a model that was doing drugs and was like 20 years old? What would you tell them?
Stop. Ask for help. Yeah. I think one of the biggest, you know, for anybody, but for like, you know, if you're a model, don't believe the hype. Don't believe what you're putting out there. You know, your face, your body is, you know, it shouldn't be, you say, a commodity, but it is, especially if you're in that realm. Know that. Understand that, treat it like a business, stay away from it, you know, in the sense of like, you don't need to own it as an identity. You know what I mean? Just get on with life, treat it as what it is. It's very superficial. You're partaking in selling yourself for somebody else to utilize your image to make them money. So you're a hoe. And I know that. I know that's what that part is. I'm a nice hoe and I'm a good hoe. But it's like, it is. It is what it is. You know, I'm out there selling that I don't give a fuck about. Like a lot of times, you know, fashion, like who cares? Who gives it really? There are people who give a shit. But, and it's billions of dollars of an industry. And that's why they want you as a product, as a thing, you know, to sell their product. And so just knowing that, but also, you know, just, you know, do things that, you know, will help you support you know, being good at your job. And if you're using, you know, get clean. You don't need that. You don't need to be loaded to be good at. I mean, that's one thing, you know, for me, like being an artist, like, you know, and for me, like modeling was a part of creating artwork. I was a part of that, you know, but the commercialized aspect is a different, it's a different thing, you know, and we get that in that industry. And, you know, but ask for help, ask for people, you know, find people in your life, find mentors, find people in your life that, you know, that you respect. And if they're up, don't let them be your mentor. If somebody's up, they ain't a good mentor. You need somebody that's like in your life that's going to like, if, like really help you. And, you know, it's a trip and it's a struggle to be like, to be addicted and up on drugs or up on anything. People, on relationships, you know, love. And I'll tell you right now, like people get really up. I'm in a relationship now. I have a trans boyfriend and that's the first experience for me in my life. It's like, it's huge. Such a letting go what I think I know about thing. I thought I was liberal-minded and open-minded and, you know, and I had to break open like what I thought. Well, I lived in a pretty infinitely gigantic box, or I didn't think I had a box, but I had a box. I realized I had a box being in my relationship, and I had to break those walls down. And that's that, just, you know, it just feels good to be able to just go really let go of my thinking. That's the one thing that's like been the biggest thing. I'll finish with this. Just what was really funny back in the day in my earlier sobrieties, I used to just clown my friends, like my fellows, my guys that I used to hang with. And I had a small group of friends that are still sober to this day, and they stayed sober. I used to clown the fuck out of them saying like, oh, you're such a little bitch. You gotta call your little mommy to check about your relationship, or if you need to change your underwear or something. Like I would just clown the fuck out of them, and you know, for like having to ask, you know, run everything by their, like be like, I'm tripping out about something today, or I'm spinning out about my girlfriend, or I'm like, you know, I don't know what, you know, can of peas to get, you know, and you know, those guys are still sober. I didn't stay sober because they learned how to ask for help. They learned how to ask for, you know, because they realize like, I don't have the answer, you know? And when you come around to that, to terms with like, I don't need the answer. I don't need to know. I don't need to know anything. All I need to do is keep myself present, see my feet on the ground and like do the, what's, you know, one thing they say in the program is like, do the next right action. You know, are you a person of principles? And that's, I think, what my daughter was asking me. It's like, or, you know, it's like, be somebody that, you know, I'm on a path to learning what principle and how to behave in that way. And sometimes I have to ask. Sometimes I ask my baby is my partner. I have to ask them like, am I all right right here? Am I being a dumbass right now? Or will just straight out check my ass, you know? And I'm in a space enough to just go, okay. You know, if I look underneath like whatever I'm obsessing on, I'll find like where I'm trying to control or some old, you know, kind of behavior that makes me a sick person. I'm exercising that. And, you know, and having, I kind of talked about it before about having a community and having a bunch of people available. And that's really hard. If you don't know how to ask for help, you know, from one person, how are you going to do it with many? And we need, you know, there's a, you know, a saying that it takes a village to raise, you know, a child. And it's like, when I've come to look at myself and my addiction and realize like a lot of the reason I was very, even prior to getting high, why did I want to punch myself in the face? Why did I have such deep, you know, feelings of, you know, unhappiness inside of myself? And it go there was trauma there. And I don't remember a lot. I have a really bad memory. I don't remember a lot of my childhood. And I almost like trained myself to just go like that memory, you know? So like my memory is literally trained to forget. You know, so like sitting here trying to recollect stories, I have to dig in. I have, you know, I mean, I'll talk my my face off on. But it's not easy to pull back memories from my past because a lot of it, I'm like, I don't know that shit. I don't want to remember that.
You. Yeah. Thank you. So, yeah, like, that was wild, man, the whole thing. Her story going from, you know, modeling, drinking at, not being straight at 17, drinking at 24, 24 going to dabbling in cocaine, from cocaine doing, starting snorting heroin, and then snorting heroin, going on to shooting heroin, having a child that was 1 year old that you, that was neglected because of the disease, and then going through a crazy detox that was from a mysterious concoction of drugs that's supposed to help you, and that was pretty funny. I mean,
that was fucking and then, you know, from
the, people have always helped you all the way, and then being with Madonna, and Madonna, like, putting, you know, you're, it's like a really windy story. Yeah. And from there, you know, going from Madonna and then getting the, going to Japan, from Japan, getting the girl comes back, and the kids, you know, and then from having the kids, going out to then having your daughter send you that letter.
Yeah. And, I mean, I miss, we missed my third wife in that story. I mean, we don't need to go there, you know, there's a lot there as well. Yeah. A lot of life lessons. Her name was Angela. My son Aurelius, he lives in London now.
Yeah.
He's about to be 13.
Cool.
I mean, there's a a lot there. That'll be episode 2 or whatever. But you know, it's like there's a lot there, a lot of life and growth and self-reflections. You know, when you said, like, you know, what brought me there, that third marriage was another one that kind of really had some eye-opening and, like, self-awareness stuff that happened that hadn't happened in my prior marriage. But, you know, we could talk about some other time.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
Anthony,
man.
A.K.A. Tony Ward, Lords of Chaos. Peace.
Word.
Thanks, man. That was fucking cool.
Yeah, that was crazy. Hopefully you can piece something sane out of that.
Good.
Yeah, it was all right?
It's amazing.
Good. That's good, because I was like, I don't know if it's going to be all right with you.
No, I mean, I can't believe, man, like, you know, I know a girl that has money and she's gorgeous, and she says, I just want, dude is cool. I don't care if he went to the gas station.
Yeah.
You know, that's not my prerogative. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And she's so hot and just successful. I'm like, that's, you know, it's kind of like Madonna. Yeah. It's like, dude, I don't need clout.
Yeah.
I'm already, you know, I want you because you're who you are.
Yeah.
That's so cool, man.
Yeah. And I mean, that's, you know, you know, there's a lot there, man. Like with Madonna, because she was, you know, she's a crazy customer. I just saw her recently. Yeah. I did a project.
Yeah.
Called The Sex Book. That Steven Meisel shot, the one that shot that.
Yeah.
That Dolce & Gabbana thing. And
Dating Is. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Excellent. She's right.
But it's like, yeah, I don't know what was I going off with.
What a wild story.
Oh, just I saw her. I saw her recently.
Yeah,
and she was straight edge when I met her. Straight edge. I saw maybe have like a tiny hit of a weed. She was doing. She was editing. We did a really big time video back in the day. A Madonna video, Justify My Love.
Yeah.
So I'm the male counterpart in that video with her, and she was doing the song Justify My Love with Lenny Kravitz. And, you know, we would sit in on the studio sometimes, and he'd be smoking blunts all the whole time. And she's like, oh, that's gross. Like, so she was legit straight edge. Maybe I saw her drink like a sip of champagne once, and then one time smoke weed. So super not that person.
And you saw her?
And I just saw her.
Okay.
They did a re-release of The Sex Book, and it was in Miami. And this was literally a year ago. And she was fucked on drugs.
What drugs do you think?
Knows.
Come on, listen.
Like, no, knows. I don't know.
This is the non. I mean, this is the math.
Oh, no. No, it was uppity. Whatever it was, bro. Yeah. And she was. And what was funny is I talked to my first wife, Mills, about it like a couple of days after I got back from the thing. And she's like, oh, I know what she's on, because my friend said was partying with her daughter and la la la. And they're all on this. And I don't remember the name of the drug. So it's like some version of Molly. So she's on drugs right now. She's like, she was so super, like back in the day, Madonna, super straight edge. We used to run 10 miles a day. I chain smoked and drank. And we'd run 10 miles a day. And she'd train for an hour after that. Like, she was a machine, right?
super smart, super machine, super like aggressive about getting what she wanted in life and all that. And then I saw that at that party literally a year ago. And I'm like, she didn't look like the same. She's like, she's reconstructed her face.
I saw that on the news. She's like, she looks completely different.
She got a big fake ass.
Yes, the BBL, I read about that online. And I don't even, I'm not
like,
even
totally reconstructed herself. And literally, she acted like some hoochie bitch from the hood. And I was like, who are you?
She's like, cool, you know? Like, hey.
No, she was fine. Yeah. But it's like, I'm like, it was almost like a different human. It was almost like the way she acted. Like, she was like a lady. When I met her, she was very sophisticated, very, like, together, and very, like, I don't know. I don't even know how to explain it. She was so super Hollywood, super cleaned up, has, like beautiful, like, I don't know. I don't even know how to explain it. It's just such a polar difference. And she's apparently, you know, I didn't know this exactly, but she started hanging out with the Kardashians, like, years ago. So this is years back now, but that your brain, you know, and then a lot of others may have,
they
you know,
everybody.
Have gone through, but, but fake ass, fake face, like became super fake and like was totally not that when I knew her. And that was shocking. Like for me to see her like that and just be like spun out, like mentally spun out. I'm like, whoa, what are you? Yeah, like, I was like, you're not even the same human. And I heard a lot about people talking about conspiracy theories, like the clone, that she's an alien, and she drinks baby blood and all this. I'm like, all right, whatever. But
with your anecdotal experience was a lot deeply nested in her life. Do you think she's an alien?
To me, I don't put anything out of the realm of possibility. Right. Not today. Today.
Yeah.
I don't put nothing out of
the way she's acting, baby clone. I mean something's different.
I'm telling you.
It's like you're some regular dude. You live with her,
not the same person. Wow. Yeah, I was like, okay, you're weird. And then literally we're on the deck. She's like, Tony, come here.
Yeah.
And she's like all like rubbing her big fake ass on me. And I was like, oh, okay. And I did a line of coke that night actually too. Yeah, so I was like all bumped up. And then I went over and I was on the dance floor like this, doing like this thing. And she's all like trying to rub her. She's like, gives me this little vibrator. She's like, look, I got you a platinum vibrator. Trippy, like leaving Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. That was like so many times in my life. I was living like, did you ever see Fear and Loathing?
Yes, of course. Yeah,
that was my life. Yeah, that was super cool, bro. Yeah. I appreciate it. I was like, kind of like, you know, I was like, okay. I didn't, you know, because I always have self-doubt. I'm like, oh, you're not going to like
it. No, man. Yeah, no, it was amazing.
That was cool.
You said you were in Reading.
Yeah, no, my brother, he lived in
when
Reading.
When you first said that, I've been to Reading. I've been to Aki.
Right.
I was in Reading like 10 years ago. I went. So I know what Reading looks like. So I'm like, I'm assuming safely, like, okay, he's from Reading, so he's a Reading guy. So he's just like, a small.
No, you know, I'm from San Jose.
I'm from Los Altos.
Yeah. Damn, dude.
Yeah, same place as Steve Jobs.
That's crazy. Yeah. No, my brother died in Reading. My older brother died in Reading.
Yeah.
And my younger one has lived in Reading.
Yeah, I thought you were a guy from Reading. Reading was a great place.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. I've only been there once.
And then for you saying all this, it's just like me thinking you're the Reading guy, and you're this jewelry guy, you know, celebrity. I'm like, this is definitely not the Reading guy.
Right?
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but, you know. I mean, I was fucking old. I don't know how old you are.
I'm 40, but you're genetics are.
Yeah, man. I guess. I don't know
for sure. I just
Yeah, of course.
Are you going to New York tonight? For sure, I'll see you Sunday.